Hi, I'm Maura Gillison. I'm an assistant professor of oncology and epidemiology at Johns Hopkins.
And I'm Elizabeth Tracy, director of electronic media for Johns Hopkins Medicine. So you have a paper in New England Journal of Medicine. Would you just tell me something about that?
The paper shows that HPV infection of the mouth is a very strong risk factor for oropharynx cancer, or cancers that arise from the tonsils in the back of your throat or in the back of your tongue.
So let's just talk just a little bit about HPV. Maybe you could define that.
Sure. HPV is human papillomavirus. It's a sexually transmitted virus that is ubiquitous in men and women.
And there's a lot of different types of HPV out there.
Yes, there are over 120 different HPV types that have been isolated from humans. 40 of those infect the mouth and the genital tract.
And where do the other ones go?
The other ones are on the skin. So a lot of people are familiar with HPV because HPV causes warts, the common wart on your fingers, and also, for instance, plantar's warts that you might have more commonly on your feet. They also cause genital warts, which are benign lesions of the genital tract.
And HPV is also the subject of a very controversial vaccine right now. Could you distinguish which viruses are related to that one?
Sure. The vaccine that was recently approved by the FDA protects people from infections by HPV 16, 18, 6, and 11. 6 and 11 are the viral types that cause genital warts, and 16 and 18 are the two most common viruses found in cervical cancers and also in oral cancers.
How common is infection with these types of human papillomavirus?
Human papillomavirus infection is extraordinarily common. There's a recent estimate that at any time across the world that 10% of women will have an HPV infection in their genital tract. For men, we don't know what that data is yet because the methods for detection of HPV infection in men have lagged behind detection in women by about 15 years. We are getting preliminary evidence that the infection is equally common among men, if not more common.
Why is it that men haven't been subject to surveillance the way women have?
That has to do with the history of pap smear screening for cervical cancer. It was noted that you could identify pre-malignant lesions of the cervix if you did a cervical scrape, commonly known as a pap smear, back in the 1940s. And so pap smears became commonly used for screening for cervical cancer long before people recognized that HPV was what was causing the abnormalities for the pap smear. So there was a very well-established structure for cervical cancer screening that the HPV detection field could then utilize to further understand how HPV causes the abnormalities in the pap smear that are used for screening. There is no such screening program currently among men because, for instance, penile cancers that are caused by HPV are much more rare. Anal cancers that occur in men and women are also caused by HPV. But oral cancer screening right now is restricted to visual inspection, and there is no pap smear equivalent.
So let's go from here to the relationship between these viruses and cancers in the mouth.
Well, there were several compelling case reports throughout the 80s and 90s that HPV could be found in oral cancers. And in 1998, I established a collaboration with investigators here at Hopkins to look at whether or not those were fluke occurrences or whether they happened more commonly. In that research, what we did was just do a very detailed analysis of whether the virus could be found in cancers in the head and neck, because the virus has to be there for the cancer to be caused by the virus. So in 2000, we reported that indeed the HPV virus, largely HPV 16, could be found in about 25% of head and neck cancers. Most of those cancers arose from the tonsils. Most people don't know they have tonsils in the back of their throat and they have tonsils in the base of their tongue. So the HPV could be found in about 60% of the cancers that were in the tonsil or in the base of tongue. Following up on that observation, what we did was study people with oropharyngeal cancers very carefully. Our objective was to understand what were risk factors that put individuals at risk for oropharynx cancer. We enrolled 100 people with oropharynx cancer and asked them about their behaviors, and we compared them to individuals of the same age and gender without cancer. And when we compared those two groups, we found that sexual behavior was a very strong risk factor for oropharynx cancer. We also looked at evidence of exposure to HPV using a serology test. And we found that individuals who had been exposed to HPV had a 32-fold increase in risk of getting oropharynx cancer compared to individuals who had not been exposed to HPV. Now, this dwarfed the risk associated with alcohol and tobacco. It even dwarfed the risk associated with heavy alcohol and tobacco use. So this was an extraordinary finding. That's because alcohol and tobacco are known to be the major risk factors for head and neck cancer. So it was surprising to find that HPV was a much stronger risk factor even than heavy alcohol and tobacco use. The other thing that we found was that the majority of the cancers occurred in men. So we really need to adjust our idea of who is at risk for head and neck cancer, because a lot of the people in the study had never smoked and had never drank. So I think physicians need to be aware that this cancer that we normally think of occurring in people with a long history of alcohol and tobacco exposure can happen in an individual who's never picked up a drink and never picked up a cigarette. We also found that sexual behavior was an independent risk factor. And the most strong risk factor was the number of oral sexual partners that you'd had in your lifetime.
Irrespective of whether those were same-sex partners or opposite-sex partners?
Yes, it did not matter.
When you try to discern this HPV infection, serology sometimes is not a very reliable marker. Is there no more direct means of detecting the virus?
Yes, serology is really a measure of lifetime exposure to the virus, but not everybody who has been exposed seroconverts to the virus. So another way of detecting infection is looking at current infection. And the way you look at current infection is you basically detect the presence of the virus in a body fluid. And that's what's happening when you get a pap smear, because HPV detection has now been incorporated into screening recommendations for cervical cancer. So we did look at whether or not detection of oral HPV infection at the time of diagnosis of your oropharynx cancer was a risk factor, and anyone who had an oral HPV 16 infection was at 15-fold higher risk of having oropharyngeal cancer than someone who didn't have an oral HPV 16 infection.
Okay, and so what about the relationship of HPV 18?
In our work, we find HPV 18 very infrequently in head and neck cancers. We find that HPV 16 is responsible for 90 to 95% of these cancers.
What percentage of oral cancers are accounted for by HPV infection?
Let me define first oral cancers. Oral cancers are cancers that arise from the mouth, which are also known as oral cavity cancers, and cancers that arise from the oropharynx, which is the back of the throat, including the tonsils. It's basically everything that the doctor sees in the back of your throat when you open your mouth and go, ah. That's what the oropharynx is. In the United States, approximately 60% of oropharynx cancers are HPV positive. Oral cavity carcinomas are much less frequently HPV associated. Worldwide, the estimate is that approximately 36% of oropharynx cancers are HPV positive.
Clearly, this data argues for widespread vaccination of men and women with Gardasil, with the vaccine against HPV.
Right. A lot of my patients have been upset that the relationship between HPV and oral cancers hasn't been the focus of the discussion, or at least part of the discussion about the HPV vaccine. And a lot of my patients who get this cancer are men. When you look at cancers that are HPV associated that occur in men, that would include penile cancer, anal squamous cell carcinoma, and oral cancers, that when you add those all up, it's very close to the number of cervical cancers that occur in the U.S. every year in women. So I think we need to adjust the public's perception that this vaccine is for women only and that only women are at risk. Men, I think, are at equal risk to women for having a cancer caused by HPV.
So would you say that this is the take-home message then from your paper, that this vaccine ought to be expanded to men as well as to women? What would be other take-home messages?
I think a very important take-home message is that a subset of oral cancers is caused by HPV, that these occur more commonly in men than in women, that men are at risk for cancers caused by HPV, and that our vaccine programs need to incorporate vaccination in men. First, of course, however, they have to be shown to be effective in men.
And so right now you're not persuaded that they would be effective in men?
Right now, those studies are ongoing, and we don't know if they're as effective in men as they are in women.
Any other take-home messages that you'd like to have out there related to this paper?
I think healthcare providers need to recognize that oral cancers can occur in people who don't smoke and drink. I am a practicing head and neck medical oncologist, and unfortunately, almost every week, I see a person who is a non-smoker, non-drinker, who has had symptoms of head and neck cancer for 5 or 6 months. They've gone to their physician with a neck mass or a sore throat. They've been treated with numerous courses of antibiotics because the physician isn't aware that HPV can cause head and neck cancer in a non-smoker and non-drinker.
Would you also add to patients who may be undergoing evaluation for such things that if they're not getting resolution, that they ought to seek a specialist?
Right. Several of my patients have reported that they were under the care of their physician. They were taking the antibiotics. They were surprised that the symptoms didn't go away with the antibiotics. They became concerned and they self-referred themselves to ENT. And that's how the diagnosis was made.
Okay. Dr. Gillison, thank you very much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.